Well, good afternoon, everyone. I normally, well, I have been recently chairing these things, so I think I'll just chair myself today, or rather me and Chris. I'm Martin Gorski, this is Chris Sears from the History Centre, and we'll get on in a minute to the sort of origins of this paper, but just to say first that it arises from a project we're working on called Health Systems in History. So let's begin. And I want to begin actually with Beyoncé and the Pope. What brought Beyoncé and the Pope together in September of 2015? Well, they were amongst the dignitaries who stood up in New York for the launch of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. These replaced the Millennium Development Goals of 2000, of which there have been eight, and three of those were related to health. So it was a matter of some interest in the public health community to see what the next set of these was going to contain. And here it is, good health and well-being. Looking beyond the celebrities, it's quite interesting to look at the way it's pitched, using a language of universalism, health for all at all ages, and with a quote, an encomium from Paul Farmer, who's the great spokesperson for health as a human right in low-income countries. And here he is saying global health equity is something which should be viewed as a sort of precious human right. What they actually contained were 13 subsidiary targets, some of them just going over again the health millennium development goals, things like bearing down on child and maternal mortality, but some new ones like working on traffic accident deaths and things like that. But for those of us with an interest in health systems, it was target number 8, which was a particular focus, to achieve universal health coverage, including financial risk protection, access to quality essential services, access to safe, effective, quality and affordable essential medicines and vaccines for all. So, universal health coverage, what does this mean? The word coverage comes originally from the insurance industry, so essentially it implies an entitlement under an insurance cover to income replacement when sick and to appropriate medical care. And for us over here in Britain with an NHS model, I'm sure we would also understand this idea of universal health coverage as implying that sort of public health system as well as purely insurance. However, that leaves quite a lot of ambiguity, and there are certainly critical voices who argue that that sort of definition isn't enough. It doesn't really go far enough in capturing this sense of universal health care as a real right. For example, does it mean comprehensive health services? Does it imply equity of access by place? Does it imply equity across the different relevant services between, for example, acute, mental health, community and social care and things like that? And what about, to the extent that a health system can address this, equity of outcomes? So actually, the arrival of this goal has sparked a very interesting debate in the health systems community about what is the way forward to achieve universal health coverage for low and middle income countries. And if you watch these things, it's actually the Latin American literature where there has been a really interesting focus. On the one hand, with advocates of what they call structured pluralism as the way forward. In other words, employing different kind of insurance scheme tailored to different groups within society, premised on the old sort of World Bank, World Trade Organization assumption that statist health systems were proven failures and that wasn't the way to go, and the role of the state should be sort of steering rather than rowing or providing, if you like. And the cases of Colombia and Mexico have been particularly important as sort of case studies of that approach. However, there is also, from the progressive social medicine wing, a more critical view which adopts this sort of universal health care approach. And that argues that there are other Latin American cases, Cuba classically, Chile earlier on before Pinochet, where you could see the effect of statist national health services delivering universal healthcare. And they argue that only through that route can healthcare as a human right really be ensured, and can you be sure that the sort of inequities of private provision can really be kept out. So for us as historians, with this very interesting and quite impassioned debate brewing at the moment, we thought it would be interesting to look back at the moment in time when universal health coverage, although it wasn't called that, when it actually first arrives on the agenda of international policy. And our focus is going to be mainly on the International Labour Organization, the ILO, and the fulcrum of our talk is going to be an event in 1944, the Philadelphia Declaration. The ILO was created in 1919, after the First World War, in that wave of optimism and utopianism which brought into being the League of Nations, the predecessor of the UN. It was based in Geneva, but at the moment we're interested in, it had fled war-torn Europe to Canada, to the safety of Montreal. 1944, the tide had turned in the European War, the United States had entered the conflict, and people were starting to think about the world of peace, what the world was going to be like after the conflict. Something called the Atlantic Charter had been promulgated with the US and the Western European allies stating that they were determined to sort of reinstate democracy. And so in that kind of atmosphere, the ILO came up with its charter for what workers' rights were going to look like following the war, the Philadelphia Declaration. It was a statement of what the basic political and economic rights of the worker ought to be. And among all those were the nine key branches of social security. And amongst those nine branches, medical care and sickness benefit. So this is what we're arguing is the first attempt to sort of get UHC on the international agenda. And the ILO's plan was that after the war, they would push forward and create an international convention on this, which the nations of the world, the member states, would then sign up to, and once they'd done that, then work within their own national governments to make that a reality. And to jump ahead to our story, what we're going to show is that was a complete failure. The convention was massively diluted to the extent that it no longer really had any force, and only a handful of nations signed up. We're looking here at the signing of the convention, and this gives you a sense of the sort of international esteem it had at the time. Here's President Roosevelt sitting at the right hand of the... Prime Minister Marsh of... Have I got that right? No, I meant not. But the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who was in the chair for the declaration. This is the Secretary of State for Labour, Francis Perkins from the US. You know, so this was really a sort of big deal at the moment that it was signed. Just to have a look at some of the text. Here's the main declaration, the sort of public face of the declaration. Basically, it comes to all it needs, protection and comprehensive medical care. And the kind of subtext which underlay the main declaration, here is where you get the real sort of statement of universalism. It should cover all members of the community, medical care services, whether or not they're gainfully occupied. So going beyond workplace insurance. If it's through social insurance, all members of the community get the right, and if they're not in work, someone else will pay. If it's provided for a sort of national health service, again, all beneficiaries are going to have equal rights. So they're not using the terms universal health coverage, but essentially you can see that that's the sense it's intended in. So in what we say in the next half hour or so, what we're going to try and do is give a kind of intellectual and policy history of this idea of universalism. We're going to talk about where it came from and how it got on the international agenda. And then we're going to come to the actual policy process and explain why it didn't get anywhere. And we're going to then see if that gives us any reflections on the making of international health policy today and perhaps how this history could speak to where we are now. So I'm going to just set the context before I hand over to Chris. How do we get to 1944? How do we get to this arriving as an international policy goal. Well, I actually want to take it right back to 1883 to begin. It's a crucial year. This is when Bismarck's Germany initiates the first social health insurance scheme. And I would argue that this is a key rupture in the history of health services, or what we now call health systems, within the kind of early welfare states. Before that point, medical care outside the market was provided either through a sort of residual poor law, often locally based, or through individual effort in the form of charities or mutual associations. To the extent the state, the nation state, was involved, this was either through the form of kind of small subsidies for some of these organisations, or through providing the regulatory framework. Now, the big breakthrough, the watershed of Germany's action, was threefold. First of all, it brought in employers. It formalised an employer's contribution to these social health insurance funds. Secondly, it introduced compulsion. Everybody had to join, and that created very large risk pools, safer risk pools. And thirdly, in relation to workplace accident insurance, it introduced the principle of no-fault liability. Hitherto, where a worker had a disabling accident in the workplace, legally it was considered their responsibility. They could sue the employer or whatever, but nonetheless it was an individual responsibility. Now the new principle was that this would be dealt with collectively. So this, to me, is why this is a kind of critical watershed. But anyway, over the first half of the 20th century, there was then a long period of diffusion where different nation states looked at the German model and adopted their own variants of it. So, for example, Britain in 1911 establishes a national health insurance for blue-collar workers. France, something similar in 1930. The United States looks at it in the 1910s and rejects it, but as a result of that, it then develops its own private medical insurance arrangements, things like Blue Cross, industrial insurance, and so on. After the Russian Revolution, the Soviet Union is the first to set up a sort of full public health service, what we'd now call a national health service. Thinking about some of the smaller countries, Czechoslovakia, newly independent in 1919, moved to set up a German model health insurance in the 20s. Looking at Latin America, there are some forerunners like Chile, which develops its own limited insurance model in the 1920s. Another pioneer is New Zealand, which amongst the liberal democracies in the 1930s is the first to establish a NHS. And it's important to note that this does not come politically necessarily from the left or from socialism or Labour parties. Some of it does, but some of it is coming from mainstream liberalism, which is moving away from a kind of strict individualist laissez-faire liberalism to a more sort of moderate and solidaristic form. Now, the next point to emphasise is that these developments are taking place not within national silos. Right from the beginning, the extension of health systems comes through a process of policy learning and exchange. So in other words, there's a kind of internationalism to health system development right from the beginning. This guy at the top is Theodor Lohmann, the German civil servant who actually writes the Bismarck legislation. And interestingly enough, even before he did that, he was looking at foreign examples, British-friendly societies, French policy of state subsidies for mutuals and things like that, to get his ideas. So even the beginning is kind of based on international policy learning. The French and the British both directly drew on the German example. In that cartoon, that's the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, Lloyd George, being lampooned after his policy learning trip to Germany, and he's come back with a German tuba under his arm and a pipe and things like that, but he's also learnt about the Bismarck model of health insurance. The American campaigners, the American progressives who wanted to establish social health insurance, also looked to Germany and to Britain, and they specifically used negative comparisons of the poor protection of the American worker in their publicity, albeit unsuccessful. Once Russia jumped to its new system, everyone was looking at that as a model. This is the American Henry Sigarist, one of the sort of leading social medicine thinkers in the States, who wrote a kind of key book, Socialized Medicine in the Soviet Union, which kind of explained to the West what it looked like. Down at the bottom, you're looking at William Beveridge. If you look at the appendix of the Beveridge Report to see where he got his ideas, he was looking at the Soviet Union as well, in part. As for the New Zealanders, this is Gervin McMillan, the Labour politician in New Zealand who introduces the first NHS. He was actually trying to surpass the system in Britain, the mother country. And finally, Beveridge, the Beveridge Report itself in 1942, drew on all sorts of stimuli, not just Russia, but New Zealand, Germany, etc. And once Beveridge was published in 42, well, then everybody was looking at that as an example as well. Okay, so just to sort of underscore the point that the story of health systems in welfare states is always the story of international policy learning. And I'll just quickly introduce the two organisations which we're going to be talking mainly about. Now, first of all, the ILO, created in 1919, and the idea was that in the atmosphere, the post-war atmosphere of the Russian Revolution, the West needed to come up with some sort of organisation which would provide a kind of counterfoil to that. In other words, to show that the liberal democracies could placate the worker, could head off revolutionary sentiments through its own methods. And so the idea of the organisation was to convene representatives of labour, employers and states to get together and discuss issues of moment to the labour movement, like rights to join a trade union, health and safety, working times and, of course, social security, to work towards these international conventions, which could be used as sort of levers to persuade nation states to implement these things, and also to provide a kind of central advisory service for nation states that needed to know how to do it. And what we want to emphasise is that once this organisation was set up, it was not just reflecting what nation states wanted. It took on a kind of agency of its own. It had a sort of autonomous effect. First of all, it created networks of experts. It provided a kind of bulletin, which was one way of linking them up. It had an annual conference, and it had kind of subsidiary groups, like an International Conference of Sickness Insurance Fund, which provided a forum for these experts to get together in a transnational setting. Secondly, we can point to some actors, the officials within this organisation, who seem to us to go beyond simply kind of doing what the nation states are asking, but to take a kind of advocacy role for what they wish to see. On the left, Adrien Tixier, he was a French social security expert. Next to him, Oswald Stein, he was someone who came to the organisation from Czechoslovakia and their social insurance set up. Down at the bottom, Laura Bodmer, probably the first active health economist in an international organisation, an Anglo-German woman who began as a statistician working for the ILO, and it was her who actually drafted the text of those medical care recommendations that you saw with the Philadelphia Declaration. So we think these people had some sort of autonomous agency. And also to introduce this organisation, the League of Nations Health Organisation, which is going to come into our story. The League of Nations, the UN's predecessor, normally thought of in history as pretty unsuccessful, because of course it was a complete failure in heading off the disasters of the Depression and the Second World War. And the reason for that failure is that many key nations, like the USA, didn't join in, so it was kind of always sort of limping along rather than having full attention of the great powers. But its health organisation, a kind of subsidiary organisation, did achieve some interesting things. And once again, we want to argue that there was agency here and some autonomy to kind of make the running of an international health policy. There were networks, again, whereby experts convened together to work on things like statistics, disease surveillance, and things like that. And we can also identify some key actors who arrived in this organisation, either as representatives of nation states or, again, as part of the bureaucracy. Some of you might have heard of the Stampar Medal, which is awarded by European public health schools for excellence in public health achievements. Peter Peel got it a couple of years ago. Well, it's named after this guy, Andreas Stampar, a Yugoslav public health specialist renowned for his work on rural healthcare and health centres and things like that. And so these were people, again, who were sort of taking the activities of nation states, particularly Germany, particularly that model, and building on that to kind of advocate for something more. And at that point, I'm going to hand over to Chris to sort of pick up the story.
Great. So how did the question of access to health services first arise on the ILO's agenda to begin with? Well, the main route was through its technical cooperation with its sister agency just down the road, the League of Nations Health Organization, and this was often stimulated by developments that happened at the national level. So in October 1924, the newly independent country of Czechoslovakia instituted compulsory sickness insurance as part of a new comprehensive social insurance framework. Now, crucially, this was by no means universal. It covered up to 2 million workers, but it excluded various classes of employees, such as the self-employed, temporary workers, miners, public sector employees, and so on. Nevertheless, it was considered by its advocates in the Czechoslovakian government, it was considered very progressive, and it was considered very efficient, a way of establishing Czechoslovakia's place in the international community. So it was very much a nation-building effort. It was seen to have various administrative advantages, namely the reduction of administrative costs, because the various branches of social insurance, such as invalidity, old age pensions, and so on, could be administered jointly. Nevertheless, it exposed the vast gulf between services that were provided by sickness insurance funds, such as TB, prevention and so on, and those provided by public health agencies. So by the 1920s, many sick funds, partly in order to attract members, were beginning to organise preventive activities of their own. And this potentially led to a costly duplication of effort with public health agencies. So this was a huge problem in terms of efficiency, organising health services and so on. So in order to examine this problem, in 1925, the Czechoslovakian government formally requested the League of Nations Health Organization to study the interface between public health administration and health insurance, quote, in the interest of the economic, practical and efficient organisation of public health services, including national insurance. And the League Health Organization subsequently agreed to a joint study with the ILO. Now, this issue was really politically sensitive and hugely complex. First of all, voluntary insurance schemes, wished to preserve autonomy over their own affairs, and they were very fearful of any sort of scheme that subsumed them under state control and so on. Second, the ILO wished to protect its leadership over social insurance and didn't want to be usurped by the League of Nations Health Organization, so there was kind of a conflict between these two agencies as well. And thirdly, the League of Nations Health Organization was also under pressure from various national representatives, such as the British medical officer George Buchanan, not to exert supranational authority over member states. So the League of Nations Health Organization was meant to have a kind of advisory role, but not really to tell the states what to do. And when it came to things like social insurance and health insurance, this was really starting to weigh in on national affairs. Despite this, the League of Nations Health Organization's medical director, Ludwig Ragman, considered the investigation the most important yet undertaken by the health organization of the League. So it had a huge importance attached to it at the time. Following a series of preliminary surveys at the city and national level, In early 1927, a joint ILO League of Nations expert committee was formed under the British Chief Medical Officer, Sir John Newman, who Martin explained was a kind of mainstream liberal. Composed of six nominees from the ILO and six from the League of Nations Health Organization, the committee was asked, quote, to consider the most effective methods of collaboration between health insurance organizations and the public health services. Now, the driving force of this, the Newman Committee, was a concern with efficiency and cost effectiveness rather than any sort of moral concern with increasing coverage. As Newman declared at the meeting, quote, we are spending millions of the public money on public medical services, and these millions are provided by the taxpayer. They are expended on services which a generation ago were not rendered at all. We have to justify this new kind of government expenditure. So perhaps understandably, considering the committee's terms of reference and the complexity of the subject, ultimately the Newman Committee could really make little headway into the subject, and its work over several years spinned off into various general questions about the nature of public health services, the nature of health insurance, and so on. The committee ultimately backed away from what it called a rigid system of mutual relations that could be set up everywhere, instead recommending councils of cooperative action to mediate between public health authorities and health insurance in areas such as TB prevention. And note these were social diseases that were considered particularly costly to the community. So this early stage, the name of the game was cooperation and coordination, certainly not universalism in any shape or form. But it is important to note that a concern with equity did exist within the wider ILO. So, according to members of the ILO's social insurance section, such as Adrian Tixier, coordination and rationalisation could help address the inequities in health coverage caused by a hodgepodge of insurance schemes with differential benefits for their members. So certain classes of the population had quite good protection, other parts of the population had often no coverage whatsoever. Now, a second route by which access to health services gained the ILO's attention was through its own push for compulsory sickness insurance. In 1927, the Sickness Insurance Industry Convention attempted to secure compulsory sickness insurance for all workers in industry and commerce, and a separate convention covered workers in agriculture. However, by the mid-1930s, only 15 states had ratified, and as you can see from this world map, many of these were central European states where the Bismarckian model of social insurance dominated, or Latin American countries such as Uruguay as well. And these were countries which had relatively well-developed labour movements at the time and where the influence of social medicine was also particularly strong. Now, the influence of German social insurance experts on ILO committees at this time, such as the Correspondence Committee on Social Security, really explains why the ILO took this direction, pushing this particular model of social insurance. Now, following the onset of the Great Depression in the 1930s, the ILO's rhetoric around health insurance became much more charged and much more heated. On both sides of the Atlantic, progressive officials pushed for health insurance on both humanitarian and political grounds. So in 1932, a US Committee on the Costs of Medical Care was established, and this highlighted the gross inequities in the burden of medical care costs across American society. So as you can see from this diagram here, basically the poorest in American society are bearing the brunt of medical care costs. Now, despite opposition from various organised interests, including the medical profession, the committee recommended various forms of cost-sharing, including federal aid and compulsory health insurance for the wealthier industrial states. However, the organised interests composed their own minority reports, so it was highly controversial. One of the problems at the time was actually that the public health consequences of the Great Depression itself was actually highly contradictory. And in fact, over the course of the Great Depression, many health indicators, such as mortality and morbidity, actually improved. And this cast into whole doubt the social medicine ethos of the League of Nations Health Organization and so on. According to recent research by Martin McKee and colleagues, actually the wider effects of the epidemiological transition was more important than the Great Depression itself. Despite this, the human consequences of poverty were undeniable. In 1933, the ILO official Otto Olsen suggested that unemployed and disenfranchised youth could even turn to political extremism if they didn't have protection from social and economic risks. So basically, a case was being built for social security in this period, which was later reflected in the New Deal reforms in the US by 1936. One of the more insidious effects of the Great Depression, however, was the slashing of public health budgets by many governments around the world. As financial pressures on health services mounted, calls for better coordination and rationalisation of health services resurfaced with a new sense of urgency. So in February 1933, a new joint ILO, League of Nations Health Organization expert committee was formed to consider the best means of safeguarding the public health during the Depression. This was chaired by the Frenchman Georges Cain Salvador and included many prominent European advocates of interwar social medicine, including, as Martin mentioned, Andreas Stampar from Croatia and Jacques Parisot, who was a professor of social medicine from Nancy in France. The stark conclusion of this committee was that, quote, compulsory sickness insurance must be regarded as the most appropriate and rational method of organising the protection of the working classes against sickness. As the report earlier, this was highly controversial. Notably, the ILO governing body distanced itself from its findings, communicating it to member states only on the basis that it shouldn't be considered official policy. Nevertheless, the rhetoric around health insurance solidified, drawing on modernist tropes of science and rationality to support a progressive vision of advance. Now, this progressive vision only intensified with the Second World War, so as Allied governments contemplated the possibility of victory over Germany and Japan, attention increasingly turned to post-war reconstruction and the protection of populations against social and economic risks. With this buoyant mood of optimism, the ILO's position on social insurance became much bolder and much less cautious, considering only a few years before it distanced itself from this report. The 1944 Philadelphia Declaration, as Martin explained, really represented the rhetorical height of the ILO's universalism. This optimism was not only generated internally within the ILO, but was influenced by developments around the world. So the ILO officials, Maurice Stack and Oswald Stein, contributed evidence to the Beveridge Report in 1942, which, as we all know, put forward a comprehensive social security model in the United Kingdom. In the United States, the National Resources Planning Board advanced a universalist language in relation to social security there, while in Canada, the Marsh Report proposed full employment and protection against universal risks. Of course, all of these developments responded to the challenge set by New Zealand, which, once again, as Martin mentioned, established an NHS in 1938. So basically, what's happening in this period is the international policy agenda moved on from a concern with social insurance, so looking at the various branches of social insurance in isolation, things like unemployment, invalidity, maternal health and so on, instead to a kind of conception of universal social security, covering people against all the social and economic risks they could face. With the ILO's exile to Montreal with the Second World War, the centre of influence over ILO policy also drifted westward away from Geneva. US New Deal officials such as Isidore Falk and Edgar Seidenstreicher were able to use the ILO as a forum to advance international debates on healthcare, even as the domestic avenues for such debates were rapidly closing amidst hostile opposition from forces such as the American Medical Association. While sponsoring these international debates, they remained firmly attached to their own particular, more limited model of social security, one which firmly retained a link to individual workers' economic contribution via their wages. So they certainly weren't in favour of a system like the UK, for example, where it's funded by general taxation. Officials in Latin America were also in close contact with ILO officials such as Oswald Stein, helping to develop a regional social security code and arrangements for technical cooperation with the ILO before Stein died untimely as a result of an accident in 1943. Now, a major international consultation in Montreal in July 1943 brought together the officials I've just spoken about with other leading lights of the social security movement, including William Beveridge and Ian MacKenzie, who was the Ottoman Minister of Pensions and National Health. As Martin explained, though, in carving out a post-war vision of social security, ILO officials had considerable autonomy of their own to shape these debates. And the key official in this regard was the Anglo-German economist Laura Bodmer, who's very much been a hidden figure in the literature to date. In an influential report on medical care, Bodmer outlined an ambitious vision of healthcare that was universal in coverage and comprehensive in scope. So by universal, Bodmer was referring to services that covered the entire population. Comprehensive refers to the full gamut of health services, preventive care, curative care, rehabilitative care, and so on. comprehensive and universal are often used interchangeably, but actually in the literature of the time, these words were actually fairly distinct. Bodmer was most influenced by models of healthcare that were population-wide and funded by general or special taxation, such as that included in the Beveridge reports. Privately, she confided to Isidore Falk that, quote, the future will bring the unification of all health services in one public service. This does not mean, however, that the method of social insurance should not be preferred where it is more appropriate or more feasible. So while Bodmer preferred general or special taxation, an acceptable alternative in her eyes was contributory social insurance with taxation to support the care of individuals who were unable to pay. So basically we have two routes to universal health coverage established in the 1940s. General taxation on the one hand and the traditional Bismarckian model on the other. And both these routes were enshrined in the Philadelphia Declaration in 1944 and its associated recommendation on medical care. Now, I won't go into too much detail about the Philadelphia Declaration, which has already been covered by Martin, but to suffice to say that even as the Declaration received the overwhelming support of delegates at the 1944 International Labour Conference, various interests attempted to curb the ILO's enthusiasm. US officials continued to push for more flexible financing mechanisms, resisting any attempt to press nations in what Falk referred to as a common mould. And the ILO's post-war optimism quickly gave way to a kind of sober appraisal of the chances of success, especially when it came to low-income countries such as India. As the 1927 convention demonstrated, the ILO's existing record for the ratification of conventions wasn't encouraging, and now we have really plans on a very ambitious scale. So the ILO's director, David Morse, suggested that minimum standards could be used as a mechanism to boost ratification. In 1951, it was proposed that the new Convention on Social Security could either be ratified on the basis of minimum standards for low-income countries or for high-income countries, more advanced standards, which had yet to be drawn up. By 1952, however, opposition to the draft convention on minimum standards had galvanised and the draft convention was weakened almost beyond recognition. And these were reasons why. So firstly, ratification was possible by adopting just three of the nine recognised branches of social security, excluding both medical care and sickness benefit. And this is just a reminder of all the various branches of social insurance I referred to earlier. Secondly, in deference to the US, voluntary insurance was permitted as a legitimate mechanism of coverage without exception. Thirdly, low-income countries such as India could avail themselves of various temporary exceptions that allowed them to ratify the convention on the basis of standards which were effectively sub-minimum. The so-called temporary exceptions actually had no time limit attached to them whatsoever, so they could continue under these minimum standards indefinitely. But most damagingly of all, proposals for advanced standards for more developed countries were indefinitely dropped. They were forever parked on the to-do list of the ILO's governing body. So although they said by 1952, we'll return to it, they never actually did. So why did the ILO's dream of universal health coverage wither away? Well, really there were three organised groups of opponents whose combined influence in Geneva helped to water down the ambitions expressed at Philadelphia a few years earlier. Firstly, employers of several countries attacked the proposals as, quote, a monstrous experiment that was way beyond the ILO's competency as an organisation. So the ILO, of course, stands for International Labour Organisation, and that suggests that their legitimate scope is workers themselves. But now, of course, we have ambitious proposals that ostensibly covered the entire population. So now employers were pushing for a recommendation which had no legal binding force on member states, so they were opposed to the ILO basically weighing in on all people rather than just workers themselves. Secondly, the organised medical profession, represented by the World Medical Association, attacked the proposals for the way they interfered with the doctor-patient relationship. Hostile to anything resembling socialised medicine, WMA representatives were present during debates and championed the right for patients to freely choose their doctor and for doctors to freely prescribe and bill. The hyperbole of these two associations actually became quite extreme, but in addition to these two groups was the very practical concerns of low-income countries. Several countries in Latin America had legitimate concerns about how they could extend comprehensive social security to highly dispersed rural populations. And for countries such as India, whose populations were very poor and non-industrial, the proposed minimum standards were actually far too high, even as they had already been surpassed by many European countries. So to gain widespread acceptance for the draft convention, the ILO was basically forced to compromise, and in so doing, the proposed standards became more and more diluted. Now, in addition to these organised opponents were wider global trends. So following the inauguration of the World Health Organization as the LNHO's successor in 1948, social medicine suffered a serious backlash. In 1952, a WHO consultant group, including the professor of social medicine, Henry Sigarist, recommended universal health coverage and services that were free or effectively free at the point of use. But fearful of the consequences of in terms of its funding, however, bearing in mind that the US is one of the main budgetary contributors to the WHO, the WHO's executive board distanced itself from the report and instead pursued a policy of vertical biotechnical intervention, the strategy that informed its programmes on malaria, yaws and leprosy. The emerging rhetoric of the Cold War also sidelined supporters of national health insurance. For example, Sigarist's protégé, Milton Romer, was forced to resign from his position as director of the WHO's occupational and social health section. In the United States, McCarthyist hysteria and the failure of President Truman's health plan also sounded a death knell for universalism. Under President Eisenhower, US foreign policy became much more suspicious, as arguably which is happening today, the loyalty of US officials working on behalf of international organisations was questioned, including people like Milton Romer. In this hostile climate, debate around health systems was basically repositioned as a matter for national jurisdiction rather than international negotiation. So I'll end there and pass over to Martin.
So what have we shown? What do we think we've shown? Looking back over the history, one of the arguments we want to make is in favour of the sort of agency, the autonomous role of international organisations and their officials. So just to recap, we're arguing that you cannot see the history of health systems within welfare states, even at the very beginning in the 1880s, as something in a kind of national silo. It's always a case of cross-national diffusion and learning. Secondly, within those agencies, we're arguing for the existence of these kind of networks of expertise, or you might call them epistemic communities. People who are thinking beyond the nation, they're rooted in the nation state, that's where their expertise comes from, but once they get into the international arena, they're thinking beyond it. And our view is that in the interwar period, it's the German Bismarck model which is shaping internationalist thinking. But in the 1940s, once the New Deal gets going in the States and Latin American insurance projects are developing, America sort of then kind of takes the lead as Europe descends into chaos. But nonetheless, you know, we've got these sort of communities of experts. Although as a footnote, given the points Chris made about this World Medical Association of the doctors who try and slow it all down, we also need to note the existence of transnational oppositional networks too. But finally, you know, the sort of key point here is that you've got these officials who are doing more than just reflecting the policies of nation states. They're trying to actually make a lead. They're trying to actually advocate for what the world should be like through this method of international conventions. Nonetheless, thinking about the whole arc of our story, it seems that much of that didn't count for a great deal, because when it came to the crunch, it was the wishes of the nation states, the great powers, which determined the way things shook out. So, you know, the idealism of the war quickly dissipated, Cold War realities quickly dawned, American sort of isolationism and things like that. From the British point of view, as a late colonial power, it was fine, you know, Britain had the NHS, but what would it mean for its, you know, dependent, you know, the fag end of colonialism, still dependent powers, you know, so those considerations were in play. Then these very practical concerns of the low-income countries, how could they sign up to something so demanding at that stage of their economic development? And finally, again, just to underline Chris's closing point, that where health system politics were sort of inflammatory issues of national health politics, as in America, then as today, you know, that compromised the kind of internationalist position they could adopt. So finally, just to come back to the now and the Sustainable Development Goals and our thinking about UHC today, I just throw out some thoughts really for how this history speaks to the present. One thing it clearly shows is that the battle to achieve universal health coverage and the debates over what exactly it implies, there's nothing new about that. Just as back then we had advocates like Laura Bodmer, Adrian Tixier, who thought that, you know, a general public health service, tax-funded, was kind of going to come, you know, that was the future, versus those who, like the Americans, who maybe accepted that was coming in the distant future, but for now, some kind of pluralistic, voluntaristic, plus, you know, different kind of public inputs, you know, that, what I might call incremental pluralism was the way forward. And I think that maps on, actually, in quite an interesting way to today's cleavage between structured pluralism and the human rights approach to UHC. Back then, again, you know, you've got this divide between the pragmatists, those who are saying, okay, it's all very well having this kind of utopian dream, but we've got to think about how we can actually get there. And very much, you know, that's with us today. It's fine to talk about universal entitlements, but let's just go step by step. You know, what is the basic essential package? Let's universalise that, and then let's go on. But actually, if you do that, if you surrender the idealism, maybe you just give up everything. Maybe, you know, that allows the vested interest to come in. Haven't you got to cling on to the human rights sensibility? So I think there's an interesting sort of circularity in these debates. They do seem to sort of map on to what was happening then as well. There is clearly, though, the pragmatic objection, which we saw in 1949 to 52, from poor countries. How can they sign up to something like this when they are still at, you know, a level of economic development which doesn't give them much latitude? And I think the kind of ways people are thinking about this today, you know, what are the kind of successful case studies? What are the countries we can point to? Places like Thailand and Ethiopia, poor, you know, low, middle-income countries, but they seem to have got a model which other countries can learn from. Maybe that's the answer, but we've got to grapple with that question. Need also to be aware of this point we were making about the oppositional networks. You know, there will be opposition. Where does it come from, and how? What's the response? And just finally, back to the world superpower, the United States, which was so important at the key moment when the Declaration was being formed and then diluted. What about its position today? Because clearly, looking at Trump trying to unroll Obamacare, the United States is once again in a position of huge controversy about its own health system. It seems to be backing away from the move to universalism at home. It's broader politics, just as they were in the early 50s, are moving towards sort of populism, nationalism, America first, you know, the McCarthy period back then, and so on and so forth. So again, you know, then, just as now, there seem to be some interesting questions we can ask about what kind of leadership the US is going to play at this crucial juncture. And with that, we'll leave it. Thank you very much for listening.